and welcome to Season 3, Episode 25 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Drs. Justin Winzenberg and Stephen Jones. In this podcast, we look to explore truth, beauty, wisdom, and goodness at the intersection of faith and scholarship. In today's episode, Justin and I talk about intercultural competence through the lens of the intercultural development continuum. But first, here are our highlights, lowlights, and insights, which we recorded back in May.
Week.
So a highlight for me is that we have a guest right now who is a grad from Crown, and so it's really fun. So Elise is here.
Oh, no way.
Yeah,
nice. Tell her say hi.
Yeah, I'll do that. She spent a little over a month in India and then is spending a few weeks here with us on her way back, and she's volunteering with us. And it's really fun because there is a whole bunch of stuff that she really enjoys doing that's kind of been piling up. And so she's the perfect fit for the kind of volunteering that happens to be needed right now. So besides the fun of, you know, yeah, being with her and interacting with her, there's also the really welcome contribution that she's making in some of the areas. My dad left last week and then Elise came the next day. And then we've got a bunch of people coming soon. And there's just a certain amount of excitement that's generated with people coming and going.
Nice. That's great.
How about for you?
Well, we're kind of approaching the most wonderful time of the year here in academics, which is when pretty much almost all things are graded and like the year is wrapping up and you're about to exhale and get a pretty significant break here.
Yeah.
It seems like summers always fly by, as I'm sure you remember. I've got already a list of things to do over the summer for work. That means my summer's not going to be just relaxation, but yeah, there's the energy like around campus is very interesting this time of year, where there's some nervous energy but excitement, and the weather's turning and like everything, you know, it just seems like you know that feeling of just being close to done for the year.
Yep.
So it's a good time, and I'm really looking forward. We're heading off on vacation after the year wraps up here. We've got a few things planned for this week, but also we got some hectic things. We're getting some work done on our house, so I'm going to start tearing up our upstairs and start to doing some demolition. So I got a lot going on between now and when we head out.
Is this the big project you were going to do like a couple of years ago? I think you had started getting ready for it.
Yeah, it is.
Nice.
Yep. And I got a friend who's doing the work for us, who owns a construction company, but he kind of said, hey, whatever you could do to do demolition will only save you money. So I'm like, nice. Well, I think if I can chisel out a couple days here, that maybe it could save me some money to start tearing stuff up out there. But then we've got other things that we're prepping for to get ready for a trip and to get stuff ready for my summer class, things like that. So it's a bit of a hectic time of year, but it's also, I think it's going to make vacation that much more energizing.
So let me ask you, I found that often when I got to the end of summer, the list that I had at the beginning of summer, let's just imagine there were 10 things on it. Often I would have gotten like 4 of them done. And then what, like for the part that isn't done for you, is it, I'm assuming you're having a similar experience to what I had. I don't know, but is it the kind of thing where you realize, you know, 3 of those 6 things that I didn't get done actually didn't need to be done? Or like, then do you have to cram and get it all done? Or how do you experience that?
Well, I think that I can see a couple things on the list. They'll probably be the ones that take priority that just have to be done. Uh-huh. I mean, I've got some things I need to do to prep for an important class that we have coming up, and I've got some paperwork I need to submit, things like that. So I've got classwork stuff that has to be done. That kind of has to be done. So I'd be scrambling. If I don't finish it over the summer, I'll be scrambling as the fall arrives. There are other things that are hopeful things. Write an article. Read this book.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff is all hopeful, but not necessarily required by any means. Or if I don't get it done, I don't get it done. It's not like I have to do any of those things. But so yeah, that's the kind of stuff that we'll see how far I get on. Mm.
What's a low light been for you?
Well, this is relatively minor. And as a Minnesotan, again, I can't help but mention the weather, but not the weather here. The weather here has been pretty nice. It's actually, we're going to hit 80s Fahrenheit this week.
Nice.
But we're going on vacation and I see the UK's weather is like 60 degrees Fahrenheit or lower if you go up to Edinburgh. So it's like that tricky thing where we've been in this winter, this awful winter, and we're finally going to be going on vacation and we're going to be downgrading weather wise. So my hope, I don't care about the 50s and 60 degree weather. I can handle that. I just don't want it to rain the whole time we're there. So it looks like there's some speculation that rain may be happening, but we're still a week plus out. So we'll see.
See what happens. Yeah.
So it's a pretty minor low light, but it's the kind of thing where isn't that the bummer? You plan these vacations so far in advance and you don't know what the weather might be like.
No idea, right? Yeah.
No idea. Yep. But that's okay. I think we'll still have a good time regardless. So it's a pretty minor low light, but I was just looking at the forecast thinking, oh boy, here we go.
Yeah. Yep.
How about for yourself? What's a low light?
I think a low light from the last week was I've mentioned this off and on. I've been working on this book project and it's for a number of reasons, it's taking us a lot longer to really get a solid start on it than I had hoped.
Is this a book you're writing or?
No. So I have a couple of those that are also in kind of various states of being stalled, but this one is a woman in Ukraine who's been writing. She's been chronicling her experience with the war, but I took a half day to just focus on that last week and really kind of got into it, you know, trying to get a feel for the content again. And it just is so heavy. It's just so heavy. Mm. You know, there's different layers as I'm listening to that and as I'm processing. I say listening because I did a text-to-speech thing so that I could kind of get through the material, like try to experience it a little differently rather than just looking at the words. Yeah, I don't know. I think there's the side of it that's heavy of saying, okay, how do we help present this in a way that's good for the reader and accomplishes some of the goals that we have for the book? And then there's the heaviness of like, this is this woman's experience, right? This is the kinds of thoughts she's having to think about, the conversations she's having with her kid, you know, just, I don't know. So I think I'm glad that we're doing the project. I really hope it is able to move forward soon and quickly. And yeah, but I don't know. I feel like I'm still kind of waiting for the insight of like, what will the experience of this book be like for the reader? Cause I think it can't be too much like it was for me this last week. Cause it's just too heavy. So I don't know.
Well, too heavy isn't necessarily bad. You know, I think about powerful, you know, Night Is by Elie Wiesel. Mm. Like that's not an easy read. Like you can't read any of these accounts of people's experiences from, you know, from the Holocaust or just these very, you know, dark historical moments and not be left with a pretty heavy impression. So in some ways you don't have to avoid that, but you know, I guess it really just depends on the goal of the book, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. And I think that's part of what that's part of why we've done a number of books, but this one is different. It's different. And I think part of it is, you know, I mean, it continues to be written. And we had originally hoped that it would not still be being written at this point. So I think that's part of the heaviness of it is there's not a conclusion of any kind of a narrative arc. Right. I think that's a lot of what I'm feeling. Yeah.
Man, you always have so much more insightful and yet also at times heavier low lights than I do. Well,
I'll go with this too. It's still cold here.
What's the weather?
Okay, so it's sunny today. So I'm very happy about that. Yep, I'm in short sleeves. Yeah. So there is that. So there was a group of us here at Sprig and we went over to our house for lunch. We have a patio. You've been out on our patio in the back and we were able to eat out there. And it's the first time we've eaten outside this whole year. And so that was nice, but it was the kind of thing where like the sun wasn't shining there. It was shining, you know, like it was blocked by the building and, you know, it was really nice. I had to take some trash out and it was really nice and warm where the trash was, but not where our terrace was, you know? So little things like that. So I resonate with the complaints about the weather.
You can't help but think about weather this time of year, but you're talking about your first time being outside, man. We had a moment, I think in April where we were outside and then the next week we got 6 inches of snow dumped on us.
Yeah.
Like we're eating outside. Oh man, that was frustrating.
Yeah.
So what is an insight for you then this week?
I think I'm at a point where, so maybe the insight is a defense of my non-insight which is that I'm kind of in this place right now where we've got a whole bunch of things that are incomplete and where it feels like there's a fair amount of pressure for various reasons to get moving on them or to make more progress on them. And I'm finding that even in my downtime right now, I'm having trouble just being, which I feel like is really important for, you know, having that reflective space. And so it's interesting kind of being in this season of like feeling kind of, yeah, pressed in a way. Like there's excitement, like I mentioned with people coming, but there's also this feeling of like, you know, you got to get ready and there's, you know, and then all these other projects that, you know, we had hoped to be further on. And yeah, I think it's interesting to be kind of in the space where I feel the lack of reflective space. And I feel that that has some amount of consequence and yet I don't see what to do about it. So yeah, just kind of interesting, sort of this like, this isn't a good sustainable space to be in terms of this season. And then kind of, yeah, not really knowing what to do about it. So it's not much of an insight other than it's interesting to in the moment be like, you know.
Well, I could tie my insight into your experience now and maybe a little on a different angle of your experience, reflecting on my upcoming vacation and how like frequently vacations aren't always restful. And so I'm prepping myself to think, you know, I'm not sure I'm going to rest. We're going to cities. We're not going, you know, to a poolside resort where we're just going to relax on the beach. But I love going to cities. And I'm like, actually for us, maybe vacation is even less about relaxing and more about like just having actual sustained time, like with your family. And in our case, our family and friends that we're going with, because it's like, how often do I get, I mean, we have weekend days here or there where we're spending a whole day together, but most days during the week, we're not.
Yeah. That was our trip to London was exhausting, but really good. You know?
Yeah, that's, I know, I felt that way too, even last year, since we jumped around so much and we had to breeze through Berlin, which was a bummer.
Yeah,
but vacation, really look forward to it. And then it's kind of stressful while you're in it.
Right.
And actually, I wouldn't say it's not relaxing. I would just say that it's because the pacing is different when you don't have something you have to be to, or you're not like, oh, got to leave tomorrow to go do this for work.
We'll be back in a moment with our discussion of intercultural competence. This show is supported by patrons, who among other things make it possible to record remotely. Reed Peters is a recognized patron of the show, and you can be too. Find our Patreon channel in our show notes.
This is where you make an interesting shift then in your chapter between conversations about culture and value orientations to then talking about, it's one thing to know culture and to be able to identify culture and value orientations. It's another thing to have intercultural competence.
Yeah.
So this is where you use a quote from Janet Bennett, where Bennett says this, knowledge alone does not equal competence. Intercultural competence requires motivation and skill. And then, so there's this idea that you have in your work that it's one thing to know what culture is, be able to identify and even identify value orientations, but it's another thing to actually be interculturally competent.
Right.
Do you want to say a little bit more just about those differences?
Yeah. I want to, on the one hand, not devalue the work of things like area studies, which focus in on a particular culture, often looking at history, religion, right? Those kinds of things. And like those things are super useful, but you can know all about a different group of people and have no ability to understand the way that they actually experience the world personally, like no experience yourself of what it's like to be them in their shoes. Kind of one of the, you know, I mean, if we talk about empathy, and I think we'll talk about this more later, but the difference between how would I feel in your shoes, which is maybe more of the sympathy thing, to how do you feel in your shoes? And
I think, interesting.
You know, it's like, I can look at your shoes. I can make all sorts of observations about it, but the reality is I don't know what it's like to be you in your shoes.
And it's interesting that even as you get further into this discussion, you invoke a quote from Slavik. And Slavik says this, that improved intercultural communication does not guarantee an end to conflict. Now, it seems that Slavik isn't actually diminishing the importance of intercultural communication, because then what Slavik says is, but nevertheless, such improvements essentially in communication can reduce misunderstanding and fear based on misperception. and ensure that when conflict does occur, parties at least have a common understanding of what the conflict is. This is
so important. It's so important.
So it sounds like, okay, there's knowing what culture is and identifying what cultural things are contributing sometimes to, say, misunderstandings in communication. Mm-hmm. But then there's the bit. So there it is. Okay, now you've identified in intercultural communication what is perhaps causing misperception or certain level of fear based on misunderstanding. But then actually resolving conflict is a whole nother thing.
Yeah, it is. And I think that this is part of where in some ways, even looking at speech act theory is super interesting. But, you know, the question of like, are we having the same disagreement is a really interesting question. And I think often we think we're having the same disagreement because we're using the same words. But if the illocutions and perlocutions are different, which often would be happening because of cultural reasons, then we may be totally missing each other, having all these communication misfires and have no idea it's even happening. And that's where it's like, you know, being on the same page in terms of what is the conflict that we're having doesn't mean there's no conflict, but it means we're at least perceiving the same conflict. So then we can try to deal with it the same way.
So I think I know where you're taking this, because I'm reminded that your dissertation is in the field of international relations.
Right.
So are you saying essentially that in international relations, for one, there's sometimes not even an acknowledgement that there are cultural differences that contribute to meaningful conflict?
I would say where culture is acknowledged, it tends to be acknowledged in ways that are not this interactional approach to culture that I was talking about, right? Mm. Where it's either more traits-based or the civilizational approach that Huntington used or Katzenstein. I actually don't know how it's pronounced. Huntington has the clash of civilizations, that idea, which breaks humanity down into less than 10 groups, basically, and says this is how different groups perceive the world. And then we can have these kind of meta conversations about how those different civilizations have conflict with each other. I find that to be way, way, way oversimplified for the question of what I'm talking about, of like, okay, but the interactional space and are we perceiving reality in the same way? It's just so much more nuanced and complicated than that. So it's not that culture is ignored, but I think that often when it's dealt with, it's dealt either in that kind of a way or in the sort of way that's talking more about customs and kind of the observable sides of behavior, you know, make sure that you don't, make sure that you're not rude, you know, make sure you're bowing far enough, those kinds of things. And so it's not like there's no attention given to culture, you know, but the type of interaction with culture that we're talking about, what I am advocating for is a much more nuanced, messy, complicated, frustrating approach to culture, but I'm doing it because I think it matters in ways that haven't been acknowledged by the field or not sufficiently acknowledged.
Yeah. So what you're really saying is that some conflicts in international relations are the result of cultural factors that have often been overlooked.
I have to hedge it always, right? Which I guess is this academic tendency, but so like Lebo, I think it was, or Lebov. I'm struggling with pronunciation here for authors that I'm not, you know, haven't been to conferences with, but in, I think it was 2008, came out with a cultural framework for international relations or international politics. I don't remember exactly how it was worded, but in that basically try to say, this is the new big theory for international relations. This is how we should look at the conflict that happens between different state actors. Mm. And to me, I don't think that's quite where I would, well, I know that's not where I would want to go with it, because I think that actually international relations has some really useful frameworks already. Mm. So neoclassical realism for me, I find very, very interesting. And so I think some of those things, you know, there are interests that states have where they have conflict with each other because they have conflicting interests, and also because they misperceive each other around things like the security dilemma and things like that, that really, like, it does us no good to explain those things away. They're really important. At the same time, I'm not sure that we're always having an accurate conversation about those interests, or having shared experiences of the interaction around those interests.
So am I right in saying that while you're suggesting there are some helpful frameworks that already exist within international relations for dealing with cultural conflicts or national and international conflict, it sounds to me like you're saying, though, that some of the developments in intercultural competency have not yet made its headway into the field.
Yeah,
as much as it probably should.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I would say there are individual authors that you see interacting with things in those kinds of ways, but it seems to be very much at the margins. Mm. Like you'll see an individual author talking about a particular culture and the way that people are perceiving the world, and where it seems like, yeah, I think that person probably has the ability to do some frame shifting, but they're not necessarily then saying, okay, this intercultural frame shifting, this ability to take the perspective of the other, the ability to interact with this interactional space, this dynamic in between us, is this necessary tool for international relations. I've seen very, very little of that.
Interesting. Yeah. And I know that, you know, since we've interacted, not only in the classroom, but outside the classroom, when it comes to the work of the IDI and how that's related to this developmental model of intercultural sensitivity. Do you want to, since this is such an important part of your work, do you want to describe to our listeners just a little bit about what that is and then how this leads you into a bigger discussion about things like denial, polarization, these various stages of intercultural competency and how that's a useful framework for your project?
Yeah, I think there's an interesting list in the dissertation that talks about different types of intercultural competence. And I think the one that I find most interesting, the one that I've spent the most time working with, is the developmental approach. And this comes again out of 86, Bennett's work. And then it was developed into an instrument in the 90s called the Intercultural Development Inventory. And then that led to its own development of a model called the Intercultural Development Continuum, which is almost the same, but not exactly the same as the developmental model of intercultural sensitivity. But basically, in a nutshell, what that model is doing is looking at the movement from a monocultural perspective on the one hand to an intercultural perspective on the other. That monocultural, we might also talk about ethnocentric, but basically one cultural perspective is central to the world. Whereas intercultural, there's this sense that there are so many different cultural experiences and interpretations of the world. And then can a person accurately perceive and interact with both cultural difference and cultural similarity? That's a really important piece there that you are also, that one is also able to interact with one's own culture and not just with other cultures.
And so the IDI, isn't it essentially sort of a survey that people take that then helps sort of place folks on a spectrum of various approaches to intercultural competency? Is that correct, do you think?
Then how I'm saying I feel like Mitch Hammer would probably resist the word survey because it's a pretty robust instrument that's had a lot of validation work on it.
But its essential way of pulling data is by asking people questions and they fill in answers.
Right.
They're multiple choice or they're not essays, right? I recall correctly from having taken the IDI, like it asks you various questions and then you answer it. And then that's a way, I'm not minimizing the research behind it, but that's a way for it to try to place people on a certain map of where they're at in their intercultural development without making a judgment call about whether that is a positive thing or a negative thing, right?
Yeah, that's essentially right. The I think it's only 50 questions or something. It came from, the wording in there came from people, their own experiences. And so it came from real grounded data in that way.
Sure.
And then, essentially what it's looking for is this question, what is your primary experience of cultural difference and similarity? And it's a developmental stage model. And so the idea is that across these various stages, one of them will be primary and there's some core issue in each stage that a person needs to resolve to be able to move into another stage. Like other stage models, there's this idea that all of the stages are present for everybody at all times, but one of them is going to be the main experience of the world. And the movement between those doesn't tend to happen very quickly.
Yeah. And so you have actually a nice chart in your dissertation on page 53 that shows some of the slight differences between the ways that these stages are articulated. But I think it might be helpful in talking about what these stages, is it correct to call them stages of intercultural development?
Yeah.
Intercultural competency?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So one of the stages that it first mentions is this idea idea of denial. What is denial as a stage of intercultural development?
Yeah. So I think one of the things that's really important to recognize is that every stage has its own strengths and weaknesses. And so, sure. And then the wording is intended descriptively, not evaluatively.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's really important. Sometimes I hear people talk about these models in ways where I think you kind of miss some of the point here, because it really is simply trying to describe a person's primary experience, and people's way that they experience the world makes sense. There's a reason, there's a story sure. behind why they're in the stage they're at.
But to be fair, so we did this together. I remember we were gathered at your dad's house.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And I remember a group of us had done this together. And I think what's interesting about the model is, visually speaking, like even as you have it on your chart on page 53, mm-hmm. Denial is sort of, we would think of it almost as the first stage. I mean, you probably wouldn't, but I think as people taking the inventory, it seems like a first stage because it's on the far left of the model. And then there's something on the far right. And so I even remember as we got our reports back and it evaluates, or at least it comments on what stage is your primary stage, that there was some feelings of like, oh, of like disappointment if you weren't on like the last stage.
Sure, yeah.
Which is visually speaking on the right hand of the model, right? Uh-huh. Because we think from left to right in our Western framework, and we think of it in a sort of a linear fashion, almost like a timeline. And even you have this direction of movement that's pointing in that direction in your model. So just to be fair, like you're right, it's, how did you put it? It's not...
It's descriptive, not evaluative.
Descriptive, yeah. Not evaluative, but those taking the survey, or again, I apologize for calling a survey, but those taking the inventory had almost this sense of like, oh, I should be on the far right.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't be on the far left. And that like somehow it's a deficiency, you know, if you're in one, then the other.
Yeah. And this is something I really try to, and I think over time I've gotten maybe better at this, I don't know, but it is really trying to help people look at the strengths and weaknesses of each stage. But the reality is often people bring the desire to do things that are easier to, I don't know if I say easier. Often people bring with them a desire to do things that are more possible on the right-hand side. And so a lot of that judgment is kind of a self-imposed judgment.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The other thing is in the instrument, there's this perceived level of intercultural development and then the developmental stage that the actual primary stage. And there was always this gap between them, not always, but almost always this gap between them. And I think that maybe what's helpful is a lot of times people are able to talk and think about cultural difference in a way that's more complex than their actual experience of it. And this is true about so many different kinds of things, right? Like, so, you know, I was working with my son on basketball, gosh, I don't know, 5 years ago, whatever. And like, so we would talk about that, and I'm terrible at basketball, by the way, but like I would, you know, talk with him about, okay, so here's, you know, how you want to dribble and here's how you want to shoot. Right. And so he would be like, okay, yeah, I get that. And he did, right. It's not that he didn't understand me, but then he would actually go to like do the thing, and he didn't have the ability yet to match his understanding of it.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And I think that's a similar idea here, that often people, because people often have kind of an intellectual understanding of cultural difference that is further along than their actual experience of it. And this is part of why the model is so useful, and the IDI can also be so useful, is that people are thinking about cultural difference in a way that's more complex than their actual experience of it.
That makes sense.
You know, it's a difference between if you're standing at the front of a classroom giving a presentation on cultural difference, and then you walk into, you know, I don't know, let's say the Mall of America, where there's people from all these different backgrounds. What's your actual lived experience when you're there at the mall compared to your ability to talk about cultural difference, you know, from the front of the classroom? That's where often a lot of that self-judgment comes from, is this sense of, well, no, but I know these things. So why
can't I do
them? Does that make sense?
Yeah. So it could be helpful for our listeners to talk through some of these stages. So again, maybe let's go to denial for a second. What is denial within this framework?
Yeah. So again, trying to, you know, I think when we hear the word denial, we often hear it like, oh man, you're in denial. And that's not what it's saying. What it's saying is that this is a person who doesn't see cultural difference as a way to understand the world. It has nothing to do with how smart a person is, nothing to do with how complex they can think about different things, complexly, how It doesn't have anything to do with the complexity of thoughts that they can have about things, right? What it is simply saying is that when a person whose primary experience is in denial looks at the world and looks at social interactions, they're not looking at culture as a primary way to explain what's happening. And it plays out in terms of disinterest in cultural difference, as well as sometimes avoidance of cultural difference.
Aha. So then, and then the next stage that's listed is polarization. How does that differ from denial?
Yeah. So the key issue that has to be resolved coming out of denial is this issue of seeing cultural difference. And you don't jump across stages. You go directly from one into the next one in a stage model. And so the next stage is this polarization. It's this idea of, okay, I see cultural difference and yuck, right? Like something.
So it's moving beyond denial and that now a recognition of cultural difference is important,
right?
But how one reacts to it now is labeled as polarizing, right? Because of what?
Because it has this us versus them sense. And there's two different ways that it plays out, which are really very different from each other and can be confusing. So the most obvious one of these is polarization defense. And this has a sense of, okay, we're the good guys and they're the bad guys. And, we're the smart ones and they're the not smart ones or whatever, but it's, you know, our group is good, which is this superiority sense, right? Our group is better. It's lucky for them. We're here, right? Those are all things you might kind of hear with that. And then there's also this denigration side of like, oh, you know, they smell bad or they're not trustworthy or whatever.
So the idea is that, okay, we know there are cultural differences, but we've got it right and they've got it wrong.
Yeah, exactly. And then the other way that polarization can play out is called reversal. And this is fascinating because I think it's a lot of times kind of a place that people get stuck. And this is where,
After going on short-term missions trips for the first time.
An example. Yeah. Or people who get involved in justice work, also have the same kind of tendency where there's this reversal, this flip of the pole where you then say, oh man, that group really has it together and we don't.
Yeah.
And so
it can cause some self-hatred towards one's own culture and this almost, this glimmery glamorization of another culture as somehow having figured it out.
Yeah. But without deep understanding of that other culture. And so it's this over-identification with an oversimplified version of some other culture. And this stage, polarization reversal is confusing because it can look so interculturally competent, on the surface compared to polarization defense, right? You look at polarization defense and you're like, well, that person, they don't like people that aren't like them. I like people that aren't like me, right?
Yeah.
But then this is part of where intercultural competence is actually looking at, okay, but do you also have an ability to appreciate your own culture? Because if not, then you're actually still using simplified frames for understanding.
Yeah, I think I've seen that happen. I remember when I was going on short-term mission trips with youth group back in the day, there were, younger white students who had never left their own cultural context who are going into the environment for the first time. And it can be a jarring thing that can lead to a defense like, oh my gosh, these people, look at how terrible their life is and how terrible they live. So that could be a defense. Like our life is so much better is sometimes what you might hear.
Well, and especially if there's this sense of our life is better because we made better decisions as a people group, right?
Exactly. But then it can go the other way, which is this sense of like, oh my, I never knew that there was this other kind of culture that, man, is so much better than what the way we do things, right? So that both of those are forms of polarization, you're saying.
Yeah. And both of those have their own strengths and weaknesses too. So I want to keep kind of hammering because it's like it's easy to look particularly at polarization defense and be like, that's just mean or, whatever.
Yeah.
But there are strengths and weaknesses. There are ways in which polarization defense can be helpful to a people group. For example, sometimes there are other groups of people that really are out to get your group of people, right? And so polarization defense pays attention to that. And that can be useful to do, right? You think about human history, there's been plenty of times where that's been true. On the other hand, polarization reversal has this strength of being able to say, you know what? Sometimes other cultures have things figured out that we don't. Maybe we should learn from them and the ability to critique your own culture. But they also both have weaknesses. And that's really important to acknowledge.
So the next stage is called minimization. But that sounds like something that could be perceived as like similar to denial. So what is minimization exactly?
Yeah. So the resolution of polarization is saying, look, we have shared humanity. That's the core issue that has to be resolved, is saying at the base, we're all people and we have that in common. And so minimization then is a minimizing of cultural differences and really focusing in on the similarities. And then also, you know, this assumption that people are having roughly the same experience of the world. Yeah.
So how's that different than denial?
Yeah. So it's different because you're acknowledging that there's cultural difference and you're using cultural difference as a way to explain the world, but it's still a fundamentally ethnocentric stage, because when you're thinking about the ways in which people from different cultures are experiencing the world, there's still this imagination that they're experiencing the world the way that your cultural group does.
Ah.
And so the types of differences that are acknowledged tend to be relatively thinner differences for the most part. You know, some places where you'll be able to acknowledge a deeper difference, for example, something that's familiar like individualism, collectivism, but this plays out in super interesting ways, right? So it feels much better as a stage in some ways than polarization, because it's like, hey, look, like, isn't it great that we're all here? You know, isn't it great that there's people from all these different backgrounds? And it's really, really fun. But then there are also tendencies to silence groups of people or to even misrepresent the needs of different groups of people. And again, not with any negative intent, often with a very good intent, but it can lead to some really catastrophic outcomes.
Yeah, and it seems like these kinds of, I'm already seeing how some of these stages are playing into some issues that are right on ground level. So I'm thinking of things that happened post George Floyd's killing and Black Lives Matter. And I'm thinking even of some of the recent controversy around critical race theory, or what people call critical race theory within, like, you know, schools and whatnot. And how, like, there's sometimes this sentiment of like, is it true, do you think, then, that sometimes minimization can show up in those conversations in this way? It's when it's like, why are we focusing on these negative things? It's usually coming right from white folks who might be like, why are we focused on these negative things when we're really all similar and we all have value, but why should we be recognizing racial difference or things like that? Is that right, do you think, or am I mischaracterizing?
I think largely correct. I think there's I would complexify that a little bit more, partially in saying that these stages are often experienced somewhat differently from people who are in the majority cultural context versus people who are coming from a minority cultural perspective. People from both of those perspectives would potentially be engaging minimization, but for different reasons, perhaps. So sometimes minimization can feel like a safer place for somebody who's having a minority experience, because you can say, hey, look, like, don't pay attention to me being different from you, because when you did, that felt bad. So let's pay attention to how we're the same. And in that way, that can also be employed from a minority perspective. But for sure, I've also heard the other voice that you mentioned, which is this kind of majority perspective of like, hey, like, let's not pay attention to all these differences. What's so important with that is that often what follows that, even though it's usually a good intent, what follows that often is a silencing of difference that actually does matter.
And I
think what's so important is that, like, because this is a developmental thing, like, somebody who's doing that often has no idea that they're doing it.
So is that in part one of the contributors then to, like, thinking of that, the All Lives Matter movement, right? Oh, that is a reaction against Black Lives Matter. So this idea of, like, by emphasizing that Black Lives Matter within the, specifically also within the context of police brutality and things like that, that the reaction against it and All Lives Matter isn't that kind of seems like it's coming from a place of minimization.
I would be hesitant to say that. And there's a couple of reasons.
And this is why I'm glad you're, I throw out the ignorant comment, and then you clarify and go, whoa. No, I'm not quite sure I would say that. Cause when I hear that, I'm thinking, oh, it sounds like a minimization of, like, no, we all matter.
It could be, yeah.
But go ahead. Yeah. Explain why I'm
sure, but it could
here.
Also be a denial statement, right? Like, if you don't see cultural difference as a way to experience the world, then why would you draw attention to it? So it could be a denial statement. It could be a polarization defense statement of saying, don't act like your lives matter more than mine do. Like, you know, mine does, you know, that kind of a feeling.
Okay.
I don't know if you'd hear it as much from a reversal perspective. I'm having trouble placing that one at the moment. But yeah. And then for sure I think maybe there would be certainly a potential of saying, hey, like, drawing attention to all these differences isn't actually helpful to anybody. And so let's emphasize. So I think if you wanted to say somebody saying All Lives Matter uncynically, because I think there's also a cynical way that that's been expressed, mm-hmm. but an uncynical expression of that could come from either denial or minimization.
Okay. So these are all labeled ethnocentric. By the way, it
could also come from later, like an uncynical expression of that could come from any of the later stages as well, right? Because you're saying humans are humans, right? And so all of us do matter. Sure. But when you're saying that with the intent of undermining a particular message.
Yeah, and subverting the Black Lives Matter movement.
Then that's a more complex thing happening there.
So these are all labeled ethnocentric stages. That doesn't sound very positive to me. So how could we say that this is not an evaluative of thing?
It's just literally what's happening. It's ethnocentric in the sense that one group of people's experience of the world is central to the understanding of the way the world is.
So and this
if you
is
don't
where
like
then,
that, then there's probably some sense in which you're like, that's not the way that I want to interact with the world.
Aha.
Yeah.
And that's where it moves into these so-called next ethno-relative stages, mm-hmm. which is so moving from minimization then into acceptance. What does acceptance mean?
So acceptance is just, I think for many people, a very uncomfortable stage. And what it is, so it's not like you cross over from ethnocentric to the ethno-relative or intercultural stages on the right-hand side and you say, yes, I made it. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, the world just got super complicated because the thing that you're having to resolve to moving out of minimization is this recognition that the world is more complicated than that. Like it's just more complicated. Mm-hmm. Yes, we have shared humanity, but it's more complicated than that. There's more going on. And then suddenly it introduces all of these questions. That's like, wait, how deep does this difference go?
And so, yeah, maybe, you know, there's the ethnocentric stages to ethno-relative, but also another way that it's put in this continuum is going from sort of a monocultural mindset into an intercultural mindset. So maybe that's a more helpful sort of model for some of our listeners who might, mm-hmm. who might inherently cringe at the idea of ethnocentrism, which is saying a lot about myself, the fact that I'm even saying that, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be cringy. The fact that ethnocentrism sounds like a bad word to me says a lot about what I think I should be, right?
Like, so imagine like there are still today in our modern world, there's at least one uncontacted people group. I don't know how many there are, but there's at least this one group of people who don't really have any meaningful interaction with the rest of the world. They should be ethnocentric.
Yeah.
It would be weird if they weren't. Right.
Like, 'cause there's not even an awareness necessarily of outside cultures.
Yeah. Now does that have impacts on their experience of the world? Like, yeah, of course it does. Like there are things that they're not perceiving accurately through that, but it would be weird if they were, experiencing the world in a different way.
That makes sense. So what is this acceptance then exactly?
Yeah, it is. And this plays out differently for different people, but it's this kind of awareness of like, okay, wait, I thought I knew how the world works and now I'm not so sure. So minimization relies on similarity and universalism as ways of explaining difference. And so this idea of, I'm kind of backing into minimization for a second to make acceptance make sense. Mm-hmm. So minimization might say something like, well, because we're all human, we all have to eat. Okay. Yeah. What acceptance does is says, okay, but does food mean the same thing to all of us? Like, does the same stuff count as food? Does food have the same social value? You know, those kinds of questions. Or universalism, we might be saying something like, either minimization or universalism, depending on how you kind of tease these out. But deep down, we all want the same things. We all want to be loved. Okay, well, what does that mean? Because actually, culturally, really, there's so much variation in what it means. That doesn't mean that there isn't this human core need for love, but we define that concept in so different of ways that just saying we all want to be loved or we all want to be accepted or we all want to belong is too simple. It's just too simple. The world is more complicated than that. It doesn't mean that there isn't a core of truth there, but it means that it's experienced so differently by different groups of people that insight that we all want to belong, for example, is not complicated enough to give us the story that we need to actually interact well with people from different cultural backgrounds.
So are you saying that both minimization and acceptance acknowledge cultural difference, but minimization tends to think that those cultural differences don't matter as much, whereas acceptance is almost the other end of that, where they matter greatly, but there's this almost sense of uncomfortability and not knowing quite what to do with it.
Yeah. So if we kind of back up, denial doesn't really perceive difference or similarity of culture, right? Okay. Because it's not perceiving culture as a way to understand the world. You move to polarization and suddenly difference is the thing that matters most, right? There's different groups and some are good and some are bad. Difference is the thing to pay attention to. Minimization then advances similarity over difference and says, you know, let's really, the thing that matters most is the similarity. Acceptance then reverses that again and says, no, difference is the thing that matters most. And this is where people can really have this kind of experience of almost feeling like paralyzed, like they don't know how to interact. And sometimes there's a really practical level. It's like, I don't even know how to say hello without being offensive. Right. And then sometimes it's, you know, these kind of more abstract levels of like, but are we even experiencing the same thing right now? You know, like, and little thoughts, like recognizing that different groups of people, even today in the world, have different years, right? That we're in this, this year is called different things for different group of people. For somebody in acceptance, sometimes that can be a really overwhelming thought. Like, wait, like we're experiencing a different year at the same time. How can that be true? Right. Those kinds of things. And then sometimes it's down to really, really, really deep stuff. Right? What does it mean to be good? Why do I want to be good? Right? These ethical questions, these questions of what is true or good, what is right? How do you relate yourself to those things? Do those things matter? That kind of stuff. And this is where it can really, really be deeply unsettling sometimes.
So acceptance doesn't necessarily have to believe in like an ethical relativism, but it could be the idea of like understanding that different cultural frameworks think differently about what's right and what's good, and that those things make sense to them within their framework. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so is acceptance acknowledging that?
Yeah, it's and I think it's a lot of times the wrestling with what does that mean? And that's where the resolution of acceptance is actually this affirmation of ethical commitments. And so sometimes we'll talk about that as a commitment within relativism. Like, okay, so yes, there are different ways of perceiving this question. There are different ways of perceiving reality, but I still have certain commitments and that's how I move forward.
Interesting. And this leads then to a next stage of adaptation. What's that?
Adaptation is in some ways a really fun stage. And sometimes I feel like it's almost a new beginning of the intercultural competence journey. Cause I would not say that somebody has arrived when they've gotten to adaptation, but adaptation is the ability to engage in cognitive and behavioral frame shifting, which means being able to experience the world in multiple ways without necessarily losing access to your own cultural group's way of it. Experiencing and interacting with the world.
So explain that a little bit more. Like, give me an example of that. Cause that just to me sounds like a danger could be that you start to try to act or talk like people in different cultures, which could be using their language and even using their colloquial like terminology. Mm-hmm. But it seems much deeper than that. It's not just an ability to like speak another person's language, right?
Yeah, no, this is where we're moving. And this is where some of the language in the literature review that gets into constructivism maybe helps complexify what's meant by this, but it's where you begin to approximate an experience of the way that somebody else would be experiencing the world from their cultural perspective.
How might this look on a ground level for somebody's living in a cultural context that isn't maybe their home context or their primary cultural context, and how would they engage in adaptation?
So here's maybe an example of this. So different cultural groups cue differently, right? They line up differently.
Yeah.
And so I can know that intellectually, and then I can practically put that into practice, right? When I go into a different cultural context by making myself line up in a way that's appropriate for that context. What adaptation is doing though, is actually beginning to experience lines in the way that people from that cultural context experience lines. And so it becomes something that's not so they're standing roughly a meter apart and this is what turn taking looks like. And this is how you advance through the line. And this is how, it looks like everybody's kind of all grouped around the counter at the same time. And it seems like other factors like who was here first or the social standing is influencing the order of service, right? That kind of thing. So that's kind of, where you're trying to make yourself do it. What adaptation involves is sometimes some of those practices of understanding maybe to get there, but it involves really, can I engage in an as if approximation of being somebody from this cultural group, which includes accurately perceiving yourself as this kind of insider outsider. So it's very different from an assimilation, where assimilation says, I'm just going to become one of the people here. Intercultural adaptation actually involves this recognition that, you know, to the extent that I'm perceived as an outsider, then I also understand what that means to perceive me as an outsider and what kind of interaction people expect from me.
That's really interesting. Yeah, maybe we need to lean in on that for a second, because, you know, I feel like I've heard stories of, well, I was thinking of missionaries who have been involved in a cross-cultural context, a context that's different than their, maybe their home culture, for a long time, and they're assimilated in that they're doing things the way that the culture does it. And maybe they don't even have to think about it, right? Because it's just such a pattern of how they're living in that culture, but who still may come from like a minimization or a polarization perspective. So again, what is that difference
including between a reversal perspective sometimes?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So what is that difference between that assimilation, that doing things the way another culture does it, and actually being an adaptation?
Yeah, adaptation involves this capacity to kind of pick up and set down different approximations of interacting with the world. And so, and this is one of the things that maybe is confusing at first glance with adaptation. Adaptation is not about, have you perfected some group's traits, right? And this is back to, what is the goal of intercultural communication? It's not, do you know all the traits and can you emulate them? Which is maybe more of an assimilation approach. Adaptation is, can I get close? And it's, you know, kind of borrowing from math, it's this asymptotic relationship where you get closer and closer. You're never actually going to get to the line, right? I'll never be somebody from that place. But can I get this approximation of experiencing the world in the way that they do? And then can I also do that with reference to my own cultural group and also with reference to another cultural group? And so this is a culture general approach to intercultural competence. Now, your specific ability in any particular culture is going to depend a lot on what you've learned. And so just because a person's in adaptation doesn't mean that they can, you know, instantly interact amazingly in every culture. But what it does mean is they possess the capacity to pick up and set down different cultural approaches to the world.
Is that what you call frame shifting?
Right. Yep. And that's okay. That frame shifting piece. And that's both behavioral, which has to do with this embodied experience, as well as cognitive. And that has to do with the, you know, so behavioral, right? Like, can I walk into a space and go to the right place in line without thinking of it, about it, because I am shifted into the frame of how people do lines here and, you know, and do eye contact in the way that people here do eye contact and do, you know, like, and on it goes. Whereas cognitive is more, you know, can I comprehend things the way that they're talking about them? And then can some of that stuff actually begin to come naturally? But again, not because I've become somebody, not because I've assimilated, but because I have this capacity to pick up and set down these frames.
Now, it looks to me, and I don't recall even having heard about this, so I apologize, because I guarantee you've told me about this before. It looks to me like there's another stage that I can't remember called integration.
Yeah. And this is where the DMIS and the IDC diverge.
Okay.
I mean, it's not the only place, but it's one of the most obvious places. And Bennett still maintains the integration stage as the sixth stage of that, whereas Hammer has not included that. But it's this question of, okay, so what happens to you when you can pick up and set down cultural frames for interacting with the world? And a former student of ours looked at that as a question of metamodernism, also looking at maybe the affective side of cultural frame shifting. And so I think that Bennett is probably right. But I also understand that Hammer's like, look, we haven't found the evidence that we need. I think it's a very difficult question to even know how to ask of, like, okay, what happens to a person's identity? And that's where Hammer says, well, I think this is actually a separate dimension that can happen. He looks at the question of cultural disengagement, whereas Bennett says this is you know, this is another stage, and Janet Bennett also has some research that goes in that direction.
So is this essentially saying, like, integration would somehow be the idea that a person could fully think and live and shift frame shift in such a way that they're like becoming part of the other culture while at the same time able to do that across cultural groups and like it back into your own. I mean, I don't understand the difference between adaptation and integration.
Yeah. So and this is where, again, every stage has its own strengths and weaknesses, right? There is this risk that moving back and forth between cultures can lead to this kind of disintegrated experience of self. And I think that's
and cultural identity.
Yeah. And identity is a huge piece at multiple stages along here. And so that's where I don't do a lot of development in the space of integration in the paper, but I think it's important to acknowledge it because I think there is this question of like, okay, so if somebody moves into the stage of adaptation, then and develops those skills, then what happens?
After discussing these stages of intercultural development, you then move into some ideas about constructivism, three different ideas of constructivism. What is that exactly?
Yeah. So there's this idea of really the question that we're trying to figure out is how do people like how does knowledge work? Right. This is an epistemological question. There's also this question of how close can I get to somebody else's experience of the world? And constructivism becomes this really important piece of that, particularly from this kind of more cognitive side of things. And so there's this radical constructivism, which has to do with the idea that at the core knowledge, that basically everything that we experience in the world is coming through constructed knowledge, that we don't actually have direct access to anything, we're using these frameworks to understand the world. And so we always only have an as-if approximation of the world, which is kind of this really interesting, unsettling idea. And social constructivism then takes that and says, okay, but that's actually coming from a group, you know, that's coming from the group. The group is helping you to understand how to experience the world and how to make sense of it. And language becomes one of the main ways in which we do that. And so there's kind of this dialectic between, radical constructivism and social constructivism, and which one of those is primary. Cybernetic constructivism deals with this question of the codes that we use to interpret the world. And how do we, you know, if you have a code set and I have a code set, and then communication is the, you know, using those code sets to relay messages back and forth, are we actually saying the same thing? And are we actually interpreting, decoding that in the same way? And how do we know, right? Those become interesting questions as well.
And so why is constructivism so important for your project?
It's so important because it's one of the foundational ideas behind adaptive frame shifting. So Singer talks about this idea that we can't share no similarity in perception, and we can't share 100% similarity in perception as people, right? That you and I will never experience the world exactly in the same way. I just can't. I don't have your lived experience, right? Just down to the very basic reality that I live in my body and you live in your body, and we won't have the same experience of the world. At the same time, because we're both human, we have ways in which we must experience the world not completely differently from one another. And then there's this whole range in between. And constructivism is helping us to look at the question of what are those constructs that we're using to make sense of the world, and then how close can we get in sharing them? How close can we get in approximating an experience of the world?
So it sounds like you're trying to avoid both the sort of pessimism of this idea of like, we're just all so different and perceive the world so differently and construct the world so differently that there's no hope for any communication across our cultures, while at the same time not trying to naively believe that things are so similar that all this is going to be easy.
Right. Yeah. And then looking at the question of, so how is knowledge developed? How is understanding developed? And then how is it communicated? And then how does it approximate those kinds of things?
Yeah. And this is something we didn't have a chance to lean into too much here yet. So maybe we'll save this for another episode, but this is the idea that like, it's not just what cultures think about things that are different, but just the very way that people even construct knowledge within our cultural context, our epistemologies are extremely different. Right. And that's so fascinating. That's something I think we'll have to lean in on maybe on the next episode. Mm-hmm. But it's such an important idea to not try to just simply minimize the idea of culture as to what people think about stuff. Mm-hmm. But that part of culture is also just the very epistemologies and the way we know.
Yeah.
Yes. One thing I found that was interesting here as you close your chapter up is you have a section on empathy. And there you're drawing some differences between sympathy and empathy, which you actually hinted at earlier. What are those differences and why, again, is it important here for your project?
Yeah, I think so. Before that, there's this idea of embodied experiences of culture, which I think is an important piece of understanding that it's not just these kind of intellectual frameworks that we look at from a constructivism perspective, but there's also this embodied reality, the body as perceiver, the body as interactor, right? That our bodies are interacting with the world. And then that also becomes part of how we interact with empathy. And there's different types of empathy. And one of the types of empathy is this reconstructive empathy, where I'm actually kind of like thinking through somebody else's experience of the world. Mm. But there's also this mirror empathy, which has to do with down to the way the brain works of looking at how my body reconstructs your body's experience of the world, just because we're both human. And it even can go beyond that. And so this experience where there seems to be something about being human where we have deeply within us this desire to understand or to relate to other people and other people's experience of being in the world. Often that's an underdeveloped skill, and it's something that we can really pay attention to, particularly in culture things. But the most important limitation is this idea of really an others focused empathy versus a self focused empathy. So a self focused empathy, which I also talked about as sympathy, is this idea of, you know, what would it be like for me to be in that situation? Whereas the other focused empathy is really pressing deeply into the question of what does it mean to be you in that situation, which, you know, you as a person who's embedded in a particular cultural way of experiencing the world, you as a person who has certain frameworks and certain experiences of reality, you who has a certain embodied way of interacting with the world as part of your culture, right? Empathy becomes a way to access that. But sometimes we stop too quickly with just the thing of, oh, how would I feel, you know, it being you.
Yeah, you engage with De Turk here, who says there's this risk of reinforcing power differentials and further marginalizing non-powerful others, even in an empathetic perspective. And so then De Turk proposes that actually the way that someone should foster relational empathy in these contexts is through dialogue. But then you seem skeptical of the idea that dialogue is going to be able to attend to these power dynamics in an appropriate way. And this is where you then lean on the work of others who say that actually rather than just thinking dialogue will be the solution to these power dynamics, that then the other centeredness rather than self-centeredness is probably a better approach, which is, I think that sums up well some of the things you were just hinting at. Is there anything more you'd like to say about that?
Just that I really enjoyed that section of the study. It's been quite a while since I've really spent time with it, but I found it fascinating, you know, looking at kind of how we seem to be as humans wired for empathy, but then also what it means to extend that and to really build that capacity out, and how intention brought to empathy can really extend the utility of it.
Yeah, this is really interesting. I appreciate the work you've done here in your literature review. It's given me a lot to think about, and just trying to sift through, you know, some of those stages of intercultural development and your work here on constructivism and empathy. I mean, really fascinating material. It's going to be very interesting to see how this foundation that you've set up in your literature review will then lead into the next section of your work, which is where you start to then address your method. And that's, I think, it's going to be very interesting for us to talk about because of some of the overlap between methods that I used in my work and methods that you've used in your work. But then also some things that you end up doing that are related to my own field of study, but something I've never engaged in my own writing. So it'll be very interesting to talk about your method, I think.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Interesting for me.
Yeah.
Wow.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. We hope you can join us for coffee again next time.
This podcast was produced by Envision Berlin in our studios located in Berlin, Germany. If you'd like to send us a note, feel free to send your email to podcast@envisionberlin.com. Thanks for listening.